I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is The Prosecutor's Legal Blues. Welcome back, everyone, to the Prosecutor's Legal Briefs. I'm Alice, and I'm joined with my perplexing co-host, Brett.
Well, hello, Alice. Perplexing. That's an interesting one. Usually that's the way we describe the mysteries, not our co-host, but that's okay. You know, this is your show.
Well, I actually think you are a perplexing character, and I think all our fans think that, too. They just keep discovering, especially in our Sea Shanty episodes on the Prosecutor's podcast, how you know everything about anything in any time period. You are a perplexing character.
Well, thank you, Alice. I will take that as a compliment, now that you put it that way. I have a lot of useless knowledge. Not a lot of knowledge about things that matter, but a lot of useless knowledge. Can't do math, but if you want to talk about really weird math problems, I can talk about those. It's like that. I just don't know what to tell you.
I don't think it's weird at all, because one of the things that we try to do in both of our podcasts, and something we're going to try to do today, is to try and unwind these perplexing headlines that seem to raise alarm. Alarm about your constitutional rights being stripped, about kind of the complete just degradation of rule of law. And we don't really know, based on these perplexing headlines, whether to worry or not, based on Supreme Court precedent. So we thought, why not? Let's delve into it.
You know, Alice, I don't know what we're going to do now the Supreme Court's done handing down decisions. I mean, this is like just a gold mine. They just keep giving us new things to talk about. So we'll just have to stretch it out as long as we can, I guess.
I guess so. I mean, I don't think you guys know exactly what we're going to talk about today, but I think you're going to love it, because we heard from lots of you. You know, the reason we've been talking about Supreme Court cases recently is, those of you who may or may not follow the Supreme Court, they go kind of during the academic year. They hear arguments and opinions are handed down throughout the year, but as they tie up their term, they release the rest of their opinions for any arguments that were heard that particular term, the term starting in October, and it goes through June. So the end of June is historically when the rest of the Supreme Court opinions are released, anyone that wasn't released during the year. And so you kind of have some big opinions that come down all at once, and people are trying to understand what they mean. And it's kind of the spotlight is on the Supreme Court, especially in June, because of these kind of hot ticket item cases coming out.
Right. And there's no question that some of you have heard about some of those opinions. Those are not the ones we're going to talk about today, though the ones we're going to talk about today were opinions that were handed down that certain people on the internet, for reasons known only to themselves, decided to act like were the end of the world. So we want to present to you sort of the scary false claim made about these decisions, and then we want to walk through what they actually did.
Indeed. Let's do that, Brett. And people still don't know what we're talking about. It's not what you think, but maybe it is. So let's start with Egbert versus Bully. Now, here is the scary false claim that you may have seen in the media. The headline, and it was a grabber, it was on every single news channel I saw. It's that the Supreme Court just created a 100-mile zone on the border where Border Patrol agents can violate your constitutional rights, and there's nothing you can do about it. Sound the alarms. That sounds terrifying.
And you may have even seen the map of this 100-mile zone. And it's kind of funny because all of Florida is in it because it's a coastal state. So everything in Florida is 100 miles from a border. But it's like this map. And it's like 90% of Americans live within these 100 miles. And Border Patrol agents can just come into your home and search it with no reason anytime they want to because of this Supreme Court opinion. And shockingly, I know you'll be surprised, that is not actually what happened.
And I can understand, though, because if you just look at the headlines, you can't really understand what it's talking about. But what does the opinion actually say? First of all, as with all of the cases we discuss, all opinions are public. You can find them online on the Supreme Court's website. Many different websites like SCOTUS blog will also kind of link you to the opinion. So these opinions are there for you to read. And they are not difficult to understand. But sometimes if you don't have a background in the subject area, it can take a little bit of background knowledge to get you up to speed. But we're here to do that work for you. But we also encourage you to read the cases yourself. Here's the truth. Where does this 100-mile, you know, no constitutional rights zone come from? Well, the 100-mile enforcement zone wasn't actually created by the Supreme Court, and it wasn't created this year. This zone comes actually from a law passed by Congress called the Immigration and Nationality Act, which was passed in 1952. So it's actually been around for about, 70 years? And it allows agents to search your vehicles within 100 miles of the border without a warrant during immigration enforcement action. This case came up when someone living close to the Canadian border who was involved in smuggling people into the United States claimed he'd been assaulted by federal agents. And he wanted damages. Damages is another word for money, under something called a Bivens action. Bivens being the Supreme Court doctrine.
And the thing that both cases we're going to talk about today have in common is they're really about money. They're about whether you can sue somebody for damages or not. That's what they're about. So, you know, it's so funny because you see this, like they created this thing and they gutted that thing. And really all they're saying is this new thing somebody tried to do where they're going to sue for damages, we're not going to let them do that. That's what they're saying. And that's what they're saying basically in both these cases. So a Bivens action, like what is that? What does that even mean? So here's the thing that you may not know. Ordinarily, you cannot sue the federal government or its agents. They have something called sovereign immunity. So the sovereign, just traditionally, going back as long as there was law and there were courts of law, the sovereign could not be sued in its own court unless it allows it to happen. So, for instance, something like 42 USC 1983, you may have heard of a 1983 action, or you may not, but it allows, 1983, allows you to sue state officials who violate your constitutional rights. So, if the local sheriff's deputy beats you up in the jail, you may be able to sue him under 1983 for damages for violating your rights. But that doesn't apply to federal officials. So you have this federal law that Congress passed, the president signed, and it specifically doesn't apply to federal officials, federal law enforcement, for instance. So basically, if you want to sue the federal government in federal court, it has to say you can. Now, it has done that in limited circumstances under something called the Federal Torts Claim Act. And that act lays out specific circumstances in which you can sue the federal government. So, for instance, if you're driving down the road and a drunk postal carrier smashes into your car, the Federal Torts Claims Act may allow you to sue for damages, right? That would be a circumstance where you're suing the federal government for damages, but the federal government has said, we are going to allow you to do that. But the Federal Torts Claim Act, it doesn't cover something like this. So this person is saying this Border Patrol agent, while he was acting under the color of law, so he's doing his job, the job that he has, he's coming into this guy's house and saying, look, we think you've been smuggling people. This person who's suing says that he was assaulted, that he was beat up by this guy, and he wants to sue him. So it's much like that case I described where a sheriff's deputy beats you up and you want to sue him. Well, he can't do it under 1983, and he can't do it under the Federal Torts Claims Act. So back in 1971, the Supreme Court sort of looked at this problem and decided this is an issue. We need to carve out something that would allow you to vindicate your constitutional rights in a court. And they created something called a Bivens action. The case is like Bivens versus six unnamed agents of the federal government or something like that. And it allows people to sue federal officers if they violate their constitutional rights in certain very narrow circumstances.
And that makes a lot of sense, right? A lot of you may be thinking, you know, why? Why can't citizens just sue the federal government? You know, we can go through some of those reasons here, but as you can see, there are exceptions to it. Imagine that every single person had a separate claim against the government no matter how large or small, the federal government. First of all, it would be untenable for the federal government monetarily, financially to defend, and also logistically to be able to defend. It would be difficult to run a government that way because the nature of a government is that it governs others. It touches people's lives, right? Every time you drive on an interstate, you are touching something that has to do with the federal government. It's very difficult to move through the lives that we have in kind of civilized society without butting up against some government action. And you can imagine what that would mean if we have millions of people interacting with the government on a daily basis and the number of claims that could be brought if there were no sovereign immunity.
And y'all know how people are. If people could sue the federal government,
litigious.
Wow. People would sue the federal government all the time. I mean, it would just be constant. You'd have to have an entirely different court system just to handle all of the lawsuits that people would file against the federal government. So sovereign immunity, it's one of those things that's just old as time. And people don't really even question it, why it exists. But there's some obvious, pretty good reasons why you want to have it.
But the whole point here is, even with that general principle that you can't sue the federal government, there are court-made doctrines like Bivens, where the Supreme Court has recognized that there has to be recourse if constitutional violations are violated. And that's a high bar. Now, this was a weird thing to do, and everyone recognized it was somewhat strange for a court to create a cause of action when Congress had failed to do so. Really quick sidebar, we have three branches of government in the United States. The executive branch, you know, the most notable person within that is the president of the United States. Then you have the legislative branch, which is made up of Congress, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. And then the third branch is the judicial branch. The legislative branch is the one that's supposed to do just that, legislate, because there are representatives from every state in Congress. And so it's supposed to be how democracy works. Causes of actions, anything in law that is created should be coming from the legislative branch. And typically the judicial branch, you know, as our forefathers described it as the least dangerous branch, is supposed to just call, in the words of Chief Justice Roberts during his confirmation hearing, call balls and strikes, right? Not create the game and not change the rules, but rather define what the law says as written in the Constitution or as passed by Congress. So that's why people recognize this was a strange thing for the judicial branch, which is not supposed to be creating law where Congress has failed to do so, actually does so in Bivens. But because of that, Bivens has been very limited. Essentially, the court has to authorize a new Bivens action anytime it's in a different context than previous Bivens actions. But basically, since they were first authorized, the court has slowly been restricting what falls under Bivens. The last 11 times the Supreme Court has been faced with a new Bivens action, they have rejected it. And it's pretty clear there will never be a new Bivens action created based on kind of this trend that we see at the Supreme Court. So when this new case came up before the court this term, the court, like the last 11 times it was asked to do so in creating a new action under Bivens, said no. Now, there was a dissent, and a dissent is someone who opposes what the majority of the court say. So the dissent is not binding law. It is someone who voted against the majority. They've lost, quote unquote, that particular action, and their opinion is not what governs our Supreme Court precedent. But they get to voice their dissent. And the dissent here wasn't talking about some fear that now 100 miles inland, there's no enforcement for our constitutional rights. It was about the deeper argument over whether Bivens actions should exist, and if so, why the court wasn't allowing new ones. So this is kind of a much deeper issue than just that gripping headline of the 100 miles where your constitutional rights are evaporated.
And let me just say, it is almost never the case that a Supreme Court opinion is solely about whatever the headline-catching thing says. Even Dobbs, even the opinion that overturned Roe versus Wade, is not just about abortion. It's about other things as well. And this is a similar case. In a lot of ways, this is a really boring opinion. It kind of shocks me that people grabbed onto this, but I think they were able to spin this 100-mile thing, so they did. But this is really wonky weird stuff. Bivens is a weird area of the law. It's very narrow. It's pretty clear that the six justices that you often think of as the conservative justices really don't agree with Bivens. They don't agree with the idea that the court can create a cause of action. And it kind of goes back to what Alice was saying. You can agree or disagree with this or not, but essentially in our form of government, the court isn't supposed to do much creating. The court doesn't discover rights. It doesn't create causes of action. It calls balls and strikes. So the legislature passes the laws. The executive, it's not supposed to create things either, other than it does have to approve the laws that Congress creates. Congress is really the one that's supposed to be creating things. And then the executive executes on what Congress did. And then when there's a question about what Congress did or how the executive executed it, or whether or not it's consistent with the foundational law, in our case, the Constitution, that's when the Supreme Court and the other courts come in to call those quote-unquote balls and strikes, to say, well, here's what the Constitution says, here's what Congress did, here's how the executive acted, and this is where they got it right or wrong. I mean, that's kind of how it's supposed to work. Obviously, that's a simplistic way to look at it. It's a lot more complicated than that. But generally speaking, you just don't see the court saying, well, Congress should have created a cause of action here. They didn't, so we're going to create one. That is a pretty extreme thing to do. And I think even the court that did it recognized that. And that's why even that court put a lot of limitations on this. And you've just seen over the years that it's never really broadened out into this fulsome thing where people are suing under Bivens all the time. And I think the three justices who were in dissent are really worried that eventually Bivens is just going to go away altogether. And even the instances in which you can sue now are going to go away. And they see that as a real loss of the ability of people to vindicate their rights in court. So that's what they're worried about. They're not worried about the enforcement zone.
And Brett, here's the thing. What the dissent is saying is they are saying something that I think gets to the heart of a lot of people, and people may be worried. What if you can't be vindicated if your constitutional rights are violated by the federal government? That is a very real concern. But here is the answer to it. Here is the Democratic answer. Just because the Supreme Court is not creating a right, and because they cannot create a right, Congress can. So let's say that Bivens no longer exists as a Supreme Court doctrine. Congress can create the right, the cause of action. And they have before under the FTCA and other laws as well. So just know that when people are kind of trying to sound the alarms that, you know, this is the end of constitutional rights as we know it, no, the answer is that it can actually be fixed or changed by Congress.
And it's not the case that there are no protections even now in this circumstance. So for that gentleman, for instance, imagine that what the headline said was true, and the agents can now just come into your home without any justification and search your home, even though the Immigration and Nationality Act specifically limits it to vehicles because vehicles are mobile. So let's say they did that. Well, number one, even if you couldn't sue them, any evidence they found would be excluded under the exclusionary rule because that would be an illegal search. Number two, the agents could be fired and disciplined by the agency if they were to do something like that. And number three, what Alice just said, if that's not enough and you see this happening, Congress can step in. A really good example of this is the Lilly Ledbetter Act. So about 15 years ago, probably, there was a lady named Lilly Ledbetter who discovered 30 years later that she had been discriminated against in her job, and she wasn't being paid what she was supposed to be paid, and she wasn't being paid that because she was a woman. She filed a lawsuit and went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, look, totally unfair what happened, but under the statute, you could only get damages for a certain period of time, and since you didn't discover this until 30 years later, and it was all very technical, you can't get the damages you should get. So they said that. Congress immediately passed a piece of legislation called the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which addressed this very problem and ensured that it wouldn't happen again and ensured that people like Lilly Ledbetter could get what she deserved. That case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. Somebody challenges that statute and the Supreme Court says Congress has acted. It's fixed, right? And that really is the way it's supposed to work. And it's the way it should work in this case if you think that there's not enough protections for people who live in this 100-mile enforcement zone close to the border. Okay, so let's move on to scary case number 2. The scary false claim that you almost certainly heard is that the Supreme Court has gutted Miranda. Now, we have talked about Miranda before on this show. We talked about how it came about. We talked about what it does. We talked about the case that created it. Well, this year, in a case called Vega versus Teco, the court was faced with an attempted lawsuit under 1983. So that statute we just talked about, 1983, which allows you to sue state officials for violating your constitutional rights. Someone attempted to sue under 1983 for violating Miranda. So Teco was accused of sexually assaulting a patient, and the police interviewed him and took a statement without reading him his Miranda rights. So they didn't do the whole "you have the right to remain silent" thing. They didn't do that. He then writes this statement where he admits to everything and apologizes to his patient. He is later tried for this. He's actually tried twice, and the statement was admitted into evidence. But bizarrely, and it's really unclear why this happened, he was acquitted despite the fact that he had a confession that he did this. He was acquitted. So rather than being thankful that although he clearly sexually assaulted someone, he was getting away with it, he decides to sue the police. He sues the police claiming that they violated his constitutional rights by not reading him his Miranda rights.
Now, at the trial level, the court instructed the jury that they could only fine for Teco if his Fifth Amendment rights were violated, rejecting the plaintiff's request for a jury instruction that he could win based on the failure to give him his Miranda rights in the first place. So he kind of asked for, if I wasn't read my Miranda rights, then I should just win. And the court doesn't quite say that. Now, since the statement had come in as voluntary in the criminal trial, this basically decided the case and Teco lost. He appealed to the Ninth Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals, although recognizing that Miranda was a prophylactic rule, nevertheless found that the district court should have given the requested instruction and allowed the violation of Miranda to serve as a basis for a cause of action.
So remember what we talked about when we talked about Miranda. It's not a constitutional rule. It's not in the Constitution that you have to be read your rights. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives you that right. The right to have your rights read is not in the Constitution. And even the court in Miranda recognized this, and they called it a prophylactic rule. It's a rule to protect your constitutional rights. So you have a right to remain silent. So we're going to create a prophylactic rule. We're going to say, because you have that constitutional right, the police have to tell you about it. And if they don't, and your rights are violated, then any evidence can't be used against you. That's the enforcement. And here, Teco is saying, well, I want to be able to sue based on the prophylactic rule. Even though 1983 is about violations of your constitutional rights. So for instance, forcing you to speak. So different from not reading your rights, but, you know, beating you until you talk, right? Something like that. That would be a violation of your Fifth Amendment rights. He wants to be able to sue for the violation of the prophylactic rule. And the Ninth Circuit says, yeah, it's a prophylactic rule, but it's kind of constitutional in nature. So we're going to let you sue under that, even though the district court said no. So at this point, the defendants, they sought to have the Ninth Circuit reconsider its decision en banc. En banc means that the entire court, or in the case of the Ninth Circuit, because it's so big, a portion of the entire court will hear the case again. So normally in an appeal, 3 judges hear your case. If it goes en banc, it might be 10 judges or 12 judges or however many judges make up the court. And that's the entire court sitting together deciding that case. But as is often the case, that request was denied. However, there were 7 judges of the Ninth Circuit who dissented from that denial. So they denied the en banc rehearing, but 7 judges said, we would have granted that hearing, and here's why. There's a judge on the Ninth Circuit named Judge Bumate who wrote for the dissenters. And Bumate, after noting that most Americans could recite the Miranda warnings by heart, then makes a statement that, while true of many people, is probably not true of the listeners of this podcast. Here's what he said. But few, I venture to guess, can identify the origin and nature of the warnings. Is Miranda a right mandated by the Fifth Amendment's self-incrimination clause? Or are the warnings prophylactic rules created by judges to safeguard the people's rights.
Now, of course, all of you know the answer to Judge Bumate's question because you are very educated and have listened to our podcast before, because the answer, of course, is the second one, that the Miranda rights are prophylactic rules created by judges. It is not baked into the Fifth Amendment within the Constitution. Now, to reiterate this point, Judge Bumate created a nifty chart. On the left are the cases calling Miranda a prophylactic rule. On the right are cases calling it a constitutional right. The left column is full to bursting of case sites calling it a prophylactic rule. The right column, nary a citation calling Miranda a constitutional right. And this chart does the job that Judge Bumate is attempting to make, which is that he writes, the court has described Miranda warnings as prophylactic at least 21 times and called them a constitutional right 0 times. And because Miranda itself is not a constitutional right, Judge Bumate and the other dissenters argued that it could not serve as a basis for a 1983 action.
So when a court dissents like this from a denial, it sends a message to the Supreme Court. We've talked about before, Supreme Court only takes 75 cases a year, 80 cases a year, not many. But when they see a dissent like this, oftentimes it sort of spurs them to action. And this strong dissent did spur the Supreme Court to take the case. And their opinion is essentially, yeah, what that guy said, which is pretty rare. The Supreme Court doesn't usually name check lower court judges in their opinions, but they did here. They specifically cited Judge Bumate and how he explained this in the majority opinion. And the court explained what you guys all know, that the enforcement mechanism for Miranda is exclusion, not a suit for damages. The alternative interpretation wouldn't work for at least two reasons. First, the obvious, the statute allows for lawsuits based on constitutional violations, and having your rights read to you isn't a constitutional right itself. And second, you'd have circumstances like this one where the statement came in, signifying that, in fact, the right to self-incrimination was not violated. The statement itself was voluntary, even though the Miranda warnings weren't given, and yet the fact of not reading the rights would still allow for a lawsuit, even though no constitutional rights were violated. So, if Judge Bumate is listening, and I'm sure he is, as you know, I'm sure all judges listen to our podcast, good work.
Yes, good work, Judge Bumate. Now, I hope that clears up some of the recent headlines we saw that cause a lot of people to be alarmed and unclear about what it meant for their own constitutional rights. These two cases, honestly, I wouldn't have picked them to be the blockbusters of, you know, kind of the news circuit, but they certainly got their airtime. Of course, there are some other heavy hitters from this term. Maybe we'll cover them, maybe we won't. But we wanted to clear up these two particular cases because they are important in you understanding your constitutional rights. And now you can kind of spread the word and let people know, you know, when they should be alarmed, when they shouldn't be alarmed. And also, if they are worried about constitutional rights or about perceived loss in rights, what the fix can be. So I hope you've enjoyed this, you know, most recent episode of the Coldwater Prosecutors, because here we are making these sexy headlines be not sexy anymore. What can I say?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's just a couple things I want to say. Number one, I don't think you can see these headlines and not think that people are trying to mislead you, because I think they are. And number two, that this is not part of some effort by people. I get it. The Supreme Court is super controversial right now, and a lot of the things it's doing are super controversial, but I think there's an effort to make it seem like everything the Supreme Court does is this huge deal. It really matters, and it's so terrible. And look, Dobbs is a big deal. I think everybody knows that. These cases aren't. You know, people made it sound like your Miranda rights were gone forever on the basis of this. And what happened was a guy had a creative argument for why he should get some money, and the Supreme Court said, nah, not going to happen. That's all that happened. Miranda itself remains exactly what it's always been, which is a non-constitutional prophylactic rule that prevents evidence from coming in against you when it's not adhered to. That's what it always has been, and that's what it remains. There are dissents in these cases. And one thing you got to remember about dissents, dissents are done for a specific reason. And a lot of times they're worded in a specific way, and they are looking to spur action. There's sort of two types of dissents. The first is a dissent that maybe one day can become the majority. So it's a dissent that says, look, this is wrongly decided right now, and I hope one day somebody will fix this. Think about Plessy versus Ferguson, which is a 7-1 decision of the Supreme Court saying that the Equal Protection Clause does not equally protect people. And there was only one justice who said, nah, I think, you know, it pretty clearly does, and this is pretty clearly wrong, and hope somebody will fix this one day. And 60 years later, in Brown versus Board of Education, they did. And that was the purpose of that dissent. Then you have dissents where they're really kind of policy dissents. Somebody was asking about our second episode where we talked about habeas, and they said, well, what do you think about Justice Sotomayor's point that because of the majority's decision, you can have somebody who had ineffective counsel at the trial level and ineffective counsel at the habeas level, and it's like they never had effective counsel. And the problem is that's a good policy argument, but according to the statute, that just doesn't give you any relief. But it signals to Congress in much the same way as the Lilly Ledbetter case did that, hey, maybe you should fix this. Maybe you should do something about this. Make sure that people do have effective counsel at least once when they're tried for something. And that can also be the purpose of a dissent. So you see dissents in these two cases, but they're not saying, oh my goodness, the world is falling apart. Miranda doesn't mean anything anymore. And now people can just come into your home within 100 miles of the border. That's not what they're saying. They're making other points. In the Miranda case, the dissent basically said in Dickerson, which we talked about before, you know, well, the courts called it kind of constitutional, so maybe that should count, basically, was their point. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not good enough. And it's just a different scenario from a case like, say, Dobbs, which is a very different kind of case, and the kind of case that, honestly, the Supreme Court might have two or three of those a year. Most of the cases the Supreme Court decides are on narrow questions, narrowly decided, usually pretty esoteric, and that should really only matter to, you know, a few eggheads and lawyers who deal in these areas. But now you're seeing all of these news stories that are trying to make you scared and afraid that everything's falling apart, and it's just not true.
Yeah, and I think that's helpful to know which ones to be kind of looking out for and recognizing the tidal wave of change. And also, it's just as important to recognize the ones that barely make a blip. Like we said in, you know, the Egbert versus Bully case, 11 times before the court had reached really the exact same decision, which was not creating a new Bivens action. And if you had followed kind of the Bivens jurisprudence, you could have predicted the outcome here. You never know exactly what the Supreme Court's going to do until they release their opinions. But you can see from kind of our discussion of it how it wasn't a surprise for those who have followed the Bivens discussion.
And I'm sorry if you're one of those people who follows Bivens. I mean, wow. I would suggest finding another
one. I'm not
going
to claim to be one of those. So we hope you've enjoyed this. And these were straight from your questions to our ears and why we looked into it, read the opinions, and tried to distill it in easy to understand terms for you all. So keep writing us in. Ask us, you know, any questions you have. But I think what you can tell from most of these episodes is if a headline grabs your attention and it makes you scared because it has just like ground shaking effects on your life and constitutional rights, maybe dig a little bit deeper before taking at face value what is being reported. And so that's what we have for this time. Is there anything you'd like to add, Brett, before we sign off for the day?
I don't think so. If you want to hear us talk about Dobbs, let us know. We can do a podcast on that one.
I don't know. You're going to have to direct it at me and try to convince me. Perplexing Brett will talk about anything. Alice might need a little more convincing. But we love talking law talk with you guys. And Brett, it's a pleasure as always. So until next time, I'm Alice.
And I'm Brett.
And this is The Prosecutor's Legal Briefs.
cases. The people tried to make sound really exciting. I'm going to go with Egbert the Boulay. I don't know if it's actually Egbert. It could be Ebert. I like Egbert. Let's go with Egbert.
I like Egbert.
And then Vegas, or Vega the Teco? I don't know. What do you think?
Teco.
Teco? All right. All right. Ready to rock and roll. Ready to roll and rock.